Tonight's program, Spotlight, Artists Set the Stage, features William Kentridge, the director and scene designer for BAM's spring production of Mozart's The Magic Flute, and legendary performance artist Laurie Anderson. From drawings to photography and film to musical, theatrical, and operatic performances, William and Laurie continue the impulse steeped in the modern tradition to use a variety of media to express their ideas. These well-known and highly admired artists need no formal introduction, and I know that all of you are anxious to hear them speak firsthand. There is information about their biographies in the handouts that you've received. The format for tonight's program is that each artist will make a brief presentation, and after that, we'll come up to the stage and begin a conversation that will then open itself up to questions from the audience.
When I was in my teenage years, and in fact this folly continued till I was well into my 20s, I had the idea of wanting to be a performer. And when I was 15, I decided I really wanted to be a conductor, because when the gramophone records were on and I had a chopstick in my hand, the orchestra behaved perfectly every time. And then somebody said, to really be a conductor, you have to be able to read music. And I said, is that absolutely essential? And I said, yes, it's difficult to be a conductor. And I said, okay, damn, so that one goes out the window. And then I thought I would be an actor. And at university, I did some acting, and then decided if I was going to be acting, I should go to theater school, where I learned very, very quickly that the one thing I should not be was an actor. So that was one of the origins of the entrance into theater, was a year spent in Paris at a school not exactly of mime, but certainly of movement. And although in the end I certainly was not an actor afterwards, I learned a great deal about drawing from the theater exercises we did. And in fact, if ever I do workshops now, drawing workshops, the exercises I give the students are almost always theater exercises rather than drawing exercises. Physical exercises, moving across a stage in a room. It's much easier to teach drawing that way than through getting simply to look at the model. The second entry point into theater when I started working in theater had to do with the slowness of animation. Now, there are certain things that animation can do, which is the field. I was making drawings and filming those drawings, and they were turning into animated films. So there are certain things that that kind of animation does very efficiently, and there are certain things it can't do at all. So, for example, it's very easy to make a crowd of 10,000 people coming over a hill, because each charcoal mark is one person, and you shoot a frame and you make a couple more charcoal marks, and your crowd multiplies and comes over the hill, which to do in real life you'd need, if you're doing Gandhi, half the Indian army to come and do that for you. So there's certain things that animation does very well, but if you have an actor, you can say, right, I'll need you to smile in one direction and scowl in the other, and it's very easy for the actor to do that. But to draw that and to animate that means that every time the face is shifting around, you have to erase the whole face, redraw it, change the expression, and you really get a crazy lump of putty that's moving around rather than a coherent figure. So there's certain things that the animation couldn't do. Movement of people across a landscape. It's very easy for a person to walk across a piece of scenery, but to have a person walking across a landscape in the system I used, which was using one drawing and erasing and redrawing on that drawing, means that as the person walks through, you're not only moving the person, but you actually have to erase the landscape and redraw it in every frame as they're moving along. So at a certain point, I had an invitation to work with a Johannesburg puppet company called the Handspring Puppet Company, who'd worked with puppets, and I'd seen their puppet work and they'd seen the films I'd made, and we thought, what would happen if we put these two things together? And my immediate thought was, well, then it's possible you can actually have someone move across a landscape, because the landscape can be the projection, and instead of animating a figure moving across, you can have the puppet. And a puppet is like a kind of drawing. It's a three-dimensional drawing. It's not naturalist. It has a similar kind of relationship to a landscape as a drawing has to a photographic landscape. for the puppets. And so I started a series of projects with the Handspring Puppet Company, the first of which was a production called Wojciech on the Highveld, which was George Buchner's Wojciech. And the second of which was a production of Faustus, which was based on the Goethe's Faustus Part 1 and Part 2. And that's what I would like, that's what I'm going to show you as a section of in a minute. So the piece, the principle of the piece was what happens if one puts puppets and animation together. And in that sense, the kind of, what Laurie was showing us and kind of the solutions to that, I kind of wish I'd thought of or had seen before all that work started. Because so many of the problems you've solved were problems we didn't manage to solve and still haven't managed to solve, but kind of I have an idea of how to solve them, having to seen some of the different ways of working with relation to the screen. I mean, there were many things that maybe when we have the second part of the conversation can be interesting, such as the interest in palindromes and anagrams. One of the films I made, which is called Felix in Exile, had that title almost entirely because of the similarity of Felix and exile. And the film then became about a whole series of other things and had, as it were, I'm interested in kind of the impurity of origins, like word games seems a very thin basis on which to start a piece of work, but for me it's very often a productive piece of work. So very often things that end up as drawings have their origin in my notebooks. There are often more phrases, sets of phrases, than there are sketches or drawings. The other thing I would also, which is to come back to, just to make a note of what are the things that jumped out, is Oscar Schlemmer's characters, these fantastic designs, which I've only ever seen in books, of unnaturalist, mechanized human figures, and which have kind of always charged me. Whenever I start a piece of theater, I often look at those and think, okay, how much of that can I do in this production? And very often one makes them and finds, in fact, on stage they die a death, and they're great in the books, but they're not great on stage. And I think that would be another thing to talk through. There are different things that happen. Just this is kind of like an apology for the film that I'm going to show you here. And one of them has to do with the difference between speed and time on stage and in film. That's only half an excuse, because there's sections of this where people are talking. When I watch it now, which is several years after it was made, I cannot believe how slowly I let everyone talk. I think even on stage it was much too slow. But on film, where one generally uses a much faster tempo of speaking and hearing and looking than would be comfortable in real life. The same way with photographs. If you have three friends and you need them to be photographed, to get them to fit into the frame, they have to crash into a really unnaturalistically tight space. And that's kind of, space changes a lot in film, and time also. So the timing of a lot of things here didn't feel nearly as bad on stage as it will look when you see it on the screen. It's an extract that's about, I think it's about 12 minutes long, but I think if we see about 6 minutes of it, that's going to be plenty. One of the problems with doing Faustus in Africa, which we did in Africa, was, and it takes as its broad theme, which is not so dissimilar to things I was interested in Magic Flute, which has to do with the weight of Europe in Africa, particularly, in my case, the weight of Faustus. When I had my bar mitzvah, one of the presents I was given by an old German friend of my parents was two volumes of Goethe's Faustus. And at 13, that just feels like a punishment, not a punishment, but a threat. You know you're not smart enough, and you know you're living at the edges of the world, because in Europe, 13-year-olds would read Faustus and they'd be able to understand it, and here we are stuck at the edge, and we know we're second rate because of this damn book sitting on the bookshelf. So when I finally, 20 years later, or so 25 years later, came back and took those books off the shelf and started reading, they were full of extraordinary things. And one of the extraordinary things in the second part of Faustus is that Faustus founds a colony. It's very seldom performed, but in the same way that in Magic Flute there are fragments that refer to the colonial project, what it is to bring lightness to the dark continent, which was also there in Faustus. And so that and the Buchner and the Mozart are all, in one sense, trying to make sense of this weight of German thinking and culture on us in South Africa, or on me as a 13-year-old and older. So Faustus comes out of Germany, and he's a German colonial in Africa. It's enough of an introduction. The rest is kind of familiar. It's just short extracts from the middle of the production. Okay, let's watch the video. Okay, I think that gives us enough of an idea of the piece. We can stop the video. Good.
That was fantastic. Let me once again say how thrilling it is for all of us to be with you, two of, I think, the most outstanding and important artists practicing today. And I want to do something that I always forget to do, which is to say to Laura Bayless, who helps organize these conversations, how deeply grateful we are to you, Laura, and all of the staff on the Education Department for pulling all of this together. So let's talk about palindromes. What's so interesting about palindromes?
They are. I mean, in the sense of the number of hours I've spent trying to work them out. And I'm really bad at it. I can't. I'm not good at doing. I suppose in teenage years, the fascination of trying to work out what are these letters that work in the different ways. I mean, you have the obvious ones, like the shortest one is just Eve. And then Madam, I'm Adam. That's the works the same if you read it either way. And then the great classic one, a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. So those are kind of genius ones. I don't know how people got to those. So I'm kind of happy when I see a word that flips or does other things. I think for me also it has to do with lists at certain points. In each project, there's a kind of a great consolation in having a list of these are possible scenes, these are possible characters, these are possible ideas, that there's often a series of, most of the notebooks are kind of lists of possibilities, and the way the work progresses week by week is changing that list. In the sense, it's very easy to understand one short phrase will stand for a whole constellation of thoughts or possible images. So I think, you know, short titles or phrases that appear either on screen or in a work function both for me as maker, but also when I'm reading it in other people as, you know, as invitations to think out from that phrase that's been offered.
You use the word magic, and it seems to me there's something magical about your performances and the video work you do, and certainly in an awful lot of what you do, William, there's a sense of magic, of things happening that you couldn't imagine, connections being drawn, imagined, that seemed impossible the moment before. Is that something very conscious that you're trying to do, to evoke a sense of mystery and magic in your work?
I mean, for me, the thing which I love about magic is not the magic part, but the knowing how it's done and seeing how it's done and still believing in what you're seeing. Yeah. So when we started working with puppets, we tried very hard to hide the manipulators entirely, thinking, well, if you saw the manipulators, you wouldn't be interested in looking at the puppets at all. And we failed. However much we tried to hide the manipulators, we tried with shadows and keeping them behind and dark cloths. They were kind of there, and in the end we were reduced to making them visible, and it took a long time to understand that was fine. That was part of... And the later performance was very much about the double performance of an actor and a puppet together, or a singer and a puppet. But one of the clearest examples of kind of magic in the sense of how it operates in our head was in a performance I saw of, I think it's Le Cirque Imaginaire, a tiny pocket-sized circus in Paris. And the magic, the astonishing magic was a person had soap and a soap dish and a little wire hoop, and he was blowing bubbles. And then he took a little hammer, and each bubble had turned into glass, and he shattered each one. You heard the glass shattering. And he did this, and it was kind of astonishing. How had they changed from soap into glass? And then he revealed his waistcoat, and on his waistcoat he had a little bell, like you would call attention to at a counter. And as he hit each glass bubble, he simply went ting with his bell. And so you could see exactly what was being done. He said, oh, okay, it's not glass, it's just soap, and it's his timing his hammer with his... But however much you saw that, you still could not stop those bubbles being glass. So I think that for me is the... it's the pleasure of... it's both the pleasure of self-deception, but it's also the inability to resist it, to make sense of these things coming together. And I think that for me is, whether it's called magic or mystery or what it is, it's that pleasure of knowing that understanding something doesn't dismantle it.
What about the role of dreaming? It seems to me that in both of your work, there are both dreamlike sequences, but Laura, you even talked about how dreams, in a sense, were the basis of some of your work. Do you spend a lot of time, do you dream a lot?
There are odd phrases that come from dreams that I've used rather than any narratives. And there are one or two images. I once did a project which was based on a boring dream I had like that. And that project arose, I was scheduled to have an exhibition and the deadline was getting closer and closer and I didn't have a clue what I was going to do in this room, in this exhibition space. And in this dream, I was in an exhibition and as I went to each piece, they were done by some artists I knew, some I didn't, as I went to each piece in this exhibition in my dream, I thought, God, if only I'd thought of that, I could have done that for this exhibition. And then I woke up and said, all right, that's what my piece would be, trying to reconstruct all these fragments that I'd seen in the dream. In the dream, there was one video piece, which I had, but I was desperate to explain to everybody, it's not my piece, it's just a test piece of tape. I've got to check the technology. I really didn't make that film at all. And in the end, it changed. The piece became integrated, all these different projects, all these different things I'd seen, but they certainly were the source of some of them, but that was an exception. But if I go to sleep, and I often wake in the middle of the night, but if I know I'm going to go back to sleep in sort of 5 or 6, then I say to Anne, my wife, okay, now I'm off to the movies, because then I know there'll be dreams that are remembered, and those are enjoyable, but most probably not repeatable.
I was also thinking a little bit, William, about, for instance, in The Magic Flute, this kind of extraordinary series of associations and illusions that are conjured up in the drawings that animate the opera. And when I was trying to pull them apart and understand the shift from one to the other, I had the feeling at times that I was in a dream because they seemed almost to morph in illogical ways and then suddenly to coalesce and you went, oh, I get it. It's about something that happened way back then.
Well, I mean, I'm pleased to say that, but a lot of the things in Magic Flute and in other pieces rely on huge generosity of the viewers to kind of make those, to say, well, you could easily watch it and say, well, this is completely incoherent. This doesn't relate to that, and the telephone's become a cat, and please. So it does require people, you know, it does require an audience and people in the audience to make those leaps and, as it were, complete the sentence or complete their own sentences from the pieces that are there. But I think there is such a... One of the things I both believe, but also, I suppose, have to believe for the work, is that there is such a kind of a narrative need in all of us, or a need, a will towards constructing a sense, that if you put two very disparate things together, we absolutely try to construct them.
Yeah.
To give an example, which uses Handspring Puppet Company, the two Handspring Puppet Companies, I phoned Basil, one of the two manipulators, and we were speaking, and I said, what's Adrian, his partner, doing? And he said, oh, he's busy doing a tree search. And I thought for a moment, I thought, tree search. And they said, of course, a tree search, it's on the internet. When you're searching for something, you have, it's like a tree. You go up the stem with one word, and then it branches into subcategories, and you can go into more and more detail until you have this whole kind of tree, not of knowledge, but of possible ideas. And so at the end of the conversation, I said, well, what's Adrian researching? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, what do you mean he's researching? I said, we said he was doing a tree search. He said, no, I didn't. I said he was doing a T-shirt. So it was, in that moment, I had heard the word, had cursed myself for being stupid for not understanding it, had constructed a whole meaning, had elaborated on it, had written the essay, and felt master of it. So I think that's kind of how you get two different images and you make a logic.
William, you manage in so much of your work, and especially in something like The Magic Flute, to move seamlessly between the sort of narrative of the opera to a very sharp political critique. Is politics an important dimension?
I think in some projects it is, but it usually comes in rather than knowing from the beginning. So I've just made a film which had to do with anamorphosis, with looking at something that's distorted and that gets corrected in a particular mirror. And that was the interest in doing the project, was in this anamorphosis, in this strange double vision of seeing something distorted and corrected at the same time in a mirror, and understanding that kind of you are constructing the correction in that mirror, or part of that. Without that double vision, the piece was incoherent. But in the end, it became about the Italians in Abyssinia in Ethiopia in 1935. And that was never part of the plan. But they kind of... I mean, this, what you're talking about, carrot and stick, I have a slightly different relationship to different projects. But there's always a stage in... I can't think of any project where it hasn't been, where halfway through where you think, if only I hadn't done this project, then I would be happy. Yeah. And you can say to yourself, yes, but remember you felt that last time and the time before that, so really it's going to be okay. No, but this time it's true. And it's a kind of a rhythm that I do feel. But for me, it's also, last year I decided I wasn't as brave to work in an Amish farm or McDonald's, but I said I was taking time out. No more exhibitions, nothing for a while. But I find that after about 2 weeks, I absolutely needed to be back in the studio and playing with possible projects, which were nice because there were nothing definite. But a week after that, suddenly they're definite, and even if there isn't a deadline, there's the same kind of... I took time off to read Cervantes, which I'd never done, and to read Gogol, which was very productive, and also to do projects which had been sort of written in a notebook. Wouldn't it be nice to do an anamorphic film or to do a projection in a daylight room and things like that?
What about politics? What about politics in your work?
As you said, it's kind of part of the raw material which is there to be used. And it would be more odd to say, all right, that's part of raw material because it's called politics or the social, it should be left aside. But rather than saying the work has to first go there, it would be odd to think about Faustus without thinking about the history of colonialism. It seems to a lot of people, I think they can think about it very easily without colonialism coming into it at all, but it seemed a very natural and would be an unnatural mapping to have left it out. So it's really by, not quite by default, but when there is politics in different projects that I've done, it's because it's so much part of the substance of the material that one's dealing with. Most of the Magic Flute is not a political opera, but there's an extraordinary political subtext and follow on from it and series of questions and thoughts that relate to the European Enlightenment and the views on other parts of the world, from Plato to where we are now, which still have such echoes. I mean, a combination of certainty of being right in the world like Sarastro, coupled with a monopoly of physical force, is kind of where we are still in the world today, those questions. So it's without, in that production, trying to focus just on that and trying to stick as close as possible to the opera. And there were certainly questions which have informed other pieces which have come out of the opera and have fed back somewhat into the production itself. I think it has to do also, if one says, what is it to be thinking about politics? It's about thinking of the world not as a fact or a series of facts, but as essentially in transition, in becoming, in the act of changing and transforming itself, which is what politics is about, how those things happen or what one does to make them happen. And I suppose that's what animation is also. The interest in animation is that it's about endless provisionality and it's about the world at 24 frames a second rather than as a photograph.
Do you draw storyboards when you start, or do you have a sense of how it's going to unfold, or is there an awful lot of experimentation?
No, I'm very bad narratively. I'm very bad at structure. So the only hope is to start somewhere in the middle and see what emerges. I mean, I start with an image. Well, you knew we were going to have God somewhere because God comes into the first scene of Faustus. So we had to draw sky. So that was kind of take that as a... Given with the films, it's easier because you say, all right, I want to do something that maybe is on the beach, so I'll spend a week drawing waves. And then there's someone on the beach, and then there's another idea, and then look at the two images on an editing table and say, well, what happened if they're there, or if they're there and something's in between? and then after 3 weeks there are four sections which can be looked at. And so as the project progresses, so it gathers a kind of finship. Obviously it's harder if one's working with a set libretto and music, but even then finding the language of it was started somewhere in the middle, looking at what is it to draw on a blackboard, to project on a blackboard, which suggested maybe you could either work with white chalk on black paper, or you could work with black charcoal on white paper and invert that electronically so that everything that's white becomes dark and vice versa. And suddenly that threw up the possibility of a photographic metaphor for the project. So that which started off as a kind of a formal technique of solving a problem of projection then became one of the informing metaphors of the whole project. Because all the times I've had good ideas, they're really terrible when they get executed. One of the things that astonishes me in your work, not in how you manage it, is that you talk about this technology, but you, in those projects, there must be teams of people doing it. And I want to know how you manage to keep such control over what you see in the face of technical expertise at the side of you. When I've worked with people like that, it's absolutely been the case of saying, well, these are the things we're going to do, tell us what to do with them. And firstly, that kind of demands a certainty. You know, you've got to act as if you know what you want. And one of the reasons that the work is very crude is because I kind of need to always make a space for me not knowing what I...
Yeah.
Let's turn this over to all of you to ask questions if you have any. Are there any questions?
Thank you very much for your presentation. I really enjoyed listening to your artistic attitude to make artworks. And as long as you use a medium as a theater, it needs to be very sociologically oriented, and also it can be very political. And my question is that when you're dealing with social issues, do you think your artwork can change the world somehow, or you don't think so? And if you think your artwork can change the world somehow, is that your aim, or it's something different?
It's a question of whether one believes that one's artwork can change the world, and whether that's its aim or whether that's a byproduct or a consequence. I do believe that art changes the world, but not through an artwork affecting the world as if the world is an object. I think if I think of what is the importance of art for me, or whether it's a novel or a film or a song, I realize that so much of me is constructed out of particular moments of having read something, heard something, seen something, which either acts as a new thought or as a confirmation, a recognition of who I am. So in that sense, I have enormous belief in why art of all kinds is completely vital and isn't simply a decoration. It's one of the ways in which we construct who we are. And insofar as art works in the world, that would be the way that I would see it working, rather than as a larger phenomenon working in a mass way. When it works in a mass way, it's working in a mass way because many individuals are strengthened, fulfilled, understood, recognize themselves, have a new idea about different things through what they've seen, rather than it having an abstract force. When I was a lot younger, I worked with, in a way, very much believing that there was a message that art or theatre or performance had to have, and it was had to have a kind of instrumental effect on the world. And I kind of got a perspective at once when I was working with a theatre company who were doing trade union plays for trade unions on the back of trucks in a huge... And we were doing one play on a stadium where there were 20,000 people for a trade union rally in the early 80s in South Africa. And we thought we were doing really well performing in that. People through loud hailers were kind of hearing and watching. And then someone in the crowd started playing a trumpet. And he came down from the bleachers and started walking around the edge of the perimeter of the stadium. And we were performing on the track in the middle. And soon there were 20,000 people marching behind or walking behind this guy playing his trumpet. And we were stuck in the middle proclaiming these good words to everyone. And it kind of gave me a sense of the gap between this belief or understanding of what we were doing and what we were really doing. And ever since then, I said, well, I'm never going to try to think on behalf of what would that person understand, so what do they need, you know, to take away the kind of the Leninist principle of what
images are needed in the world. Yes, there's no. I have a very strong belief in not making those pronouncements or trying to do that.
Is that when you started taking trumpet lessons?
That's when I should have started taking trumpet lessons. So I'm going to make this film. It's about these two characters, Soho and Felix, and so long as they make sense to me, that's kind of okay. They don't have to make sense much further than that. A few friends, the editor, it's got to make sense. And then if other people do connect, that's fine. But it was an enormous... It was such a complete failure, this activity on the back of the truck, that it was a huge opening up of other possibilities.
Other questions? Yes, please, right there.
How are you keeping up with technology? I know that Mr. Cambridge start with a drawing with a charcoal, and here you are with a three dimension with a video, with computer. How are you keeping up with all this technology?
Well, the short answer is that I haven't, but after hearing Laurie and seeing her work, Laurie, I'm getting courage to start looking at other technologies.
Laurie, I know that my daughter born into computer and into cell phone, and we didn't born into it. And how you keep up with this?
Let me ask the question a little differently, which is, when you're conceiving a new performance or a new idea, do you come up with the ideas and then look to find the solutions through technology that will allow you to realize it? Or are you aware of sort of technological possibilities and you work backwards? Aha, this could do that. I wonder if I could exploit that.
I think, I mean, more that. For me, most of the work that I've done has started with a kind of a form. So when I started working with the opera, with the puppet company, the starting point was, we're going to do puppets and we're going to do animation, they're going to be together, and we'll find what feels an appropriate material to do it. Obviously, the hope is that in the end, what one's doing, the images that one's playing with, also have more than just a formal interest, that they also have some meat, some weight to them. But that's usually... I don't think it works either to say, here's a catalogue of techniques or effects to work, or to say, here is a crystalline idea, let's analyze the best formal way to realize it. This is a film I made which uses trained ants. and if you put sugar water down on a sheet of paper and you've got an ant infestation, as we had one summer, the ants will find that sugar water, and if you film them, instead of it being a transparent line, it will look like a dark shape or dark line made with ants. And if you invert that, instead of having black dots on a white ground, you could have white shapes on a black field, so almost like stars. And if the ants take 2 or 3 hours to come to the drawing to fill it up, if you just clap your hands, they scatter instantly and then slow down and are very agitated and then slow down a bit. And then if you run it backwards, so you have two reversals, the negative to positive and the time reversal, what you have are these slowly moving, kind of randomly moving stars in the sky that start to heat up as the energy levels, and then at one fell swoop, they make the constellation. So it's kind of like well-trained ants. No, that's what happens in the film successively, or versions of that. That started because I came down for breakfast and found what I thought, there's this black mark on the breadboard, and then discovered it was some honey which was covered with ants. And then said, okay, well, instead of using Indian ink, you can use ants, and started for a while filming them on the breadboard, and then I was chased out of the kitchen because I was spreading more honey. And then had to lay a sugar water trail from the door of the studio onto a sheet of paper. And I was busy working on a different project, but this was kind of fun, so I'd allow myself sort of an hour a day to play with the ants, and to set something like that, thinking I must get on with the serious work and then do it. And then eventually I discovered, you know, I understood, okay, it was fine to work with this. So it absolutely had no kind of structure or decision. It was what was there. What are the things that suggest in its different permutations and reversals? And it's still something, I mean, there's still work to be done on more ant training. And I think that the origin of this is the way a lot of things, when I started these ants, there's, you know, every family has family sayings and stories which get told endlessly, endlessly. And one of my father's stories to us was of him as a 9-year-old, where he'd done a particularly messy piece of homework, where apparently a teacher held up his book and showed it to the class and said, look, Kentridge has had his homework done by his army of trained ants. and kind of, I tried to get that tech, an army of trained ants to do that for my father, but they would, the ants would only would all congregate on one or two letters. You could never get a whole sentence, or I couldn't do those ants. So I think those kinds of, it's a bit like the palindromes. One starts with it because it's, there's something cool and something crazy in that.
Yeah.
And then you hope, well, maybe with good fortune, it will also mean something as well.
We're going to have to do an ant program. We just acquired at the museum a rather wonderful video that Rivana Neuenschwander did of ants collecting bits of confetti after carnival in Rio and watching them meticulously pick up these microscopic pieces of confetti and laboriously carry them back to their nest and then try, of course, to get them down through the holes in the ground, which they don't fit into, and coming apart and breaking together. They're quite fascinating ants as a phenomenon. Yes, in the middle there. Please, yes.
Well, actually, ants are a perfect segue to my question.
I knew that.
my question was for William Kentridge. Thank you. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your use of animals in the magic flute, because getting back to the discussion of magic, the use of the rhinoceros and the birds, which seem particularly magical to me.
Well, I think it's very hard to do the magic flute without birds, because you have a character who is by profession a bird catcher, and they kind of have to be there. And you know in the middle of, in Act One, which is kind of what seduces everyone to both make it and to watch it, is that you know you've got three animal sequences. You've got a snake in the first scene, so you have to find some solution to how you do the snake. Usually it's a kind of papier-mâché or some other snake. In my case, it was the arm, the projection of an arm as a kind of possible snake. You know you've got the time when Papageno catches the birds. And then you've got the sequence in which Tamino charms the animals with his flute. It's a demonstration of the magical powers of music to tame even great dangers or to charm nature, the power of music. So you need to have... Some productions, they use kind of deformed, crazy creatures. I think the German calls for Wilden, for wild animals. But so the rhinoceros came there in Act One, first as kind of as farce, and then in the second act with Zarathustra saying, in fact, what is the relationship of the enlightenment he's talking about with what actually happened? In hindsight, what can we see the gap between his words in 1791 and where we are today? And what we see today is where you've had that combination of a monopoly of truth or a confidence of a monopoly of truth and a monopoly of power, such as Zarathustra has. It's calamitous. It's always calamitous. And what one is always left with is the violence rather than the knowledge. So that's why the end of it is, I mean, that's, you know, however Europe went into Africa thinking they were coming to bring enlightenment to the dark continent, what we left with at the end is a dead rhinoceros. So that's kind of how the animals got into the magic flute. But there's also something really pleasurable about tearing tiny strips of paper, and if you have a pointed one that becomes a rhinoceros horn, and then as you move it frame by frame under the camera, it kind of dances. And it's also one of the things where to train a real rhinoceros to do a handstand is very hard. But it's really easy to get these pieces of paper to do a handstand or a somersault.
Yes, and please.
It seems that you're both very drawn to a concept of sort of doubling, but I'm curious about the proportion between these sort of sides that come into play. Laura, you spoke a bit about the relationship between the figure and the shadow, the sort of silhouette of the figure on the screen behind, and I know that's something that comes up in William's work as well. But William, I'm interested in your work. You spoke about the puppet and the manipulator and that sort of relationship, yet there's a thread between both of you, an interest in palindromes and the sort of two sides that come into play. I just curious if you can elaborate a bit about how you see the scale of the sides in those situations.
I'd never thought of the shadow as a palindrome, but it's an interesting, and a mirror particularly as a palindrome, I mean as a reversal of something. I think that you'll correct me, but what Laurie was talking about wanting to think about puppets or shadows as alter egos, as a direct doubling, hadn't been, it may be what happens in the work, but it's not something I'd ever thought of. I mean, I was very interested in the end of the double performance of singer and puppet in the opera puppet production, or an actor and puppet in Faust is how you have that double vision. The principle that's not so clear in the film is that the performer focuses on the puppet and the puppet goes to the audience, and the audience has this double look from the performer to the puppet back to themselves goes round. And that kind of doubling of what the character was does interest me in on the stage.
But you both play around with alter egos and doubles a little bit. I mean, you, at least I always think of that with your violin as sort of taking on a parallel life that's engaged with you, that's responding to you. And Soho Eckstein surely acts as an alter ego, if not a double. There's something really kind of powerful about that.
I think it's one way of working kind of as a... It's not exactly autobiography in the third person, but it's definitely having someone who can do things that you don't do or can't do or wouldn't dare to do. It does kind of... But also with Soho, with the art moments where I think, well, what would I have done in the... What feels... That's really testing. What is a transformation that feels legitimate and one that feels... Not legitimate, one that feels rooted and one that feels too random. One that is maybe impossible but still viable, as opposed to transformations that are simply fantastic.
Any more questions?
There's one.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Yes. I have a question first to William. When the animations are time-based and the result is still image, I've seen your images as the prints or whatever in the exhibition, but do you want the audience to see that, let's say they don't know your animation, do you want them to see it time-based, or it doesn't matter? Like, both of them, they're separate or together?
Well, they work both ways. The question of whether which is kind of primary, an animated film or the drawings which may result from it. Or a piece of theatre, and sometimes the video that results from that piece of theatre. There isn't a kind of a priorization. I know that when I'm working on a piece of theatre, there's going to be months and months of drawing and then a very intense rehearsal period, and then people will see it in the theatre. And then after a year after that, it may exist. Drawings from it will still exist. But very often, I mean, I think of the drawings when I started making the films, the drawing were applied drawings. They were drawings done in the service of making the film. The images were not images that arose out of a kind of a drawing need, but out of what scene was needed in the film and how would that make sense. But having said that, there are a number, and still are, a number of drawings that emerge which are demanded by the project, which would never have arisen if I'd simply thought of a series of drawings. So one of the projects I did was a death list, a list of people who had died in Abyssinia, in the war with the Italians. Just simply a large sheet of paper with a lot of names written on it and various headings. And on the one hand, it was kind of a non-drawing. It was what I needed to show on the screen in the film. But once that was actually done, I really like it as a drawing. But I would never have got there at all if I'd simply thought, well, what drawing do I want to do today? So it works both ways.
Yep. Laurie, William, thank you so much for sharing this evening with us.